Blog Talk Radio.
Sometimes the planets just line up for us, you know. It's a great day. Welcome to, let me extend that to listeners all over the world, to our friends in Ireland and in the Netherlands and Germany. Thank you for tuning in. It's a pleasure to have you there. The Masonic types in India. You folks give me a pause to appreciate the spirituality and the depth of philosophy that Freemasonry brings. And how many dialects are there in India? About 1,000. How many languages? How many faiths? And yet Masonry perhaps that just creates the fertile ground for Masonry to gain an audience. I want to sometimes it's risky when you sit back and reflect on Masonry, and day by day it's you know, you'd have to be foolish not to be thinking about some of the big issues that it's like an account. Our accountant up there is giving us the sad news. We have overspent on this planet for far too long. And no, it hasn't been forever, but we really went at it with a zest. Everything around us became a commodity for our own purposes, for manufacture. Where I am, we had people with a belief that there was a respect the spirit of the streams and rivers, of the forests and the trees and the wildlife. And well, we certainly took care of that. We tried to kill it off, but that we weren't very good at that. And much to the surprise the folks that were most aggressive, most able to rationalize the behavior, it's coming full circle. We need a philosophical grip on what's happening, because nature's not negotiating with us anymore. Not that it she ever did. We're in trouble. Only I don't want to. Those nasty scientists. Let's let's put them all in a square master and head them to the horizon, and perhaps they'll all collectively fall off the edge. we're a funny tribe, but us human beings. Now we have to take some corrective steps, if we can, if it's not too late. But that feeling of inferiority, it's going to be difficult for some men to come to terms. That's just background. That's not what Masonic Effects is about. I want to bring to your attention that as if you're reasonably healthy human being, you have a sense of balance about yourself psychologically and emotionally, then you can do Freemasonry. I don't fault anybody for struggling. When you think about we're introduced to it. It's like a feeding tube. It'll keep you alive. My goodness. It's not something you want to repeat. The use of, I'll put it right out there. We use far, far too much aggression where I am. And if you're introduced to a topic with that notion that it has to be you're not naturally going to want to learn it. And the only way for you to do that is if it's mandatory or conditional on your membership. That's an alteration in the whole process. And there's nothing conditional after you've made me a Mason. Who are these men to suggest that they can inject their own approach to it? They're off base, out of line with that thinking. But if that's the way you were introduced, I think you'll find funny. I'm going to tell you about a poster that I saw. Brought in a speaker to a team in a clinic I was running to speak to us about this process of motivation, not rah-rah, take one for the team kind of thing, but what was going on in terms of biochemistry, the mind, how do you wrap your head around it? And one of his props, it was very, very interesting and engaging, this was a high-functioning team of people, and they just lit up, and they really, really they challenged them all over the place, as they tended to do. It was great fun, very rewarding for me. He put up a slide or a poster, if the only tool in your box, you've seen this, is a hammer, then all of us look like nails. All of us look like nails if the only tool you have is a hammer. So if that's the only tool, of course you're going to think that you'd have to, motivation is using that hammer. Boom, 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 boom. But due to what surfaces time and again is this... It's the way that people learn this stuff. You are capable of absorbing the deeper meaning of Freemasonry. I know it's hard when you're maybe assuming that the feeding tube doesn't fit, doesn't feel right, and you would rather do it at your own pace. Yes, it's all very valid. You're you're not wrong. But what you are experiencing, if I might add, is a form of aggression, whether you call it passive aggressivity or flat out aggression, command, you know, that type of thing. So the difference between somebody yelling orders at a young person to teach them a sport and embarrassing them when they make mistakes, or never mind, that's give you too many examples of that. It's not healthy. Or and somebody that works with the understanding that to teach the young person how to perform at their best, how to find that, their, how to build their confidence. You don't do it by ordering people around. Ah, but it works. Well, it works with some, but you're going after, but at what price? What's the cost of doing that? There is, yeah, oh my goodness, there's a price. Masonry is kind of curious. It doesn't have a prohibition on the use of aggression or mandatory training. It simply doesn't work. Oh, how dare I? Did I say that out loud? No, I think I was using my inner voice when I said that. What it cries out for is discovery and imagination. For instance, if I was wanting to instruct people about the nature of Freemasonry, I would want a sorcerer from Britain. No, more specific, I'd want an old Irishman to sit down with me and talk about the little people. I'd want a man from the Orkneys to tell me about the spirits. I'd want an old lady from York to tell me about the fairies, to teach me about them. Just as a backdrop, it's a way of settling the mind for this kind of conversation. From an early age, we are being taught a language. Often it's a faith, organized or formal or informal. We're learning about, for some of us, many of us, we learn about our sense of creation. I didn't know when I was born about creationists. I didn't know that there was going to be conflict, controversy about this. But it's always been there when I look through history. The language teaches us, we absorb this from the time we're little children by observation, by what we hear. And we want, if we're fortunate, a connection, a consistency between what is said to us and the feeling that it instills in us and the behavior of the people around us who profess to be followers of that faith. Words, language matters. We learn a particular language and we learn about this process of reverence, of respect. And we, somewhere along that continuum, put ourselves. Where do we fit? You know, I used to think that the grand architect was, you know, no, that grand architect would be competing with motherhood for the supremacy, at least in some souls. But you know what I mean. We in Freemasonry are given, taught a language. We are taught a way of processing that allows us to change our perspective in a way, to pull, if you think, pull back and examine all of these faiths, all of them, for what they are. Oh, and we're encouraged to realize that we have bias and that we can think beyond our bias once we understand that it does exist and once we accept that it's a condition that's part of the human mind. It's like coming to terms with the with that sense of viciousness, the potential for viciousness in all people, that moment of psychosis. Are we immune to that? Well, we don't talk about it because it's so troubling. Given the, there's no right conditions, but there are conditions where it can be induced and we don't necessarily look for it on purpose. Masonry comes along and allows us to examine. Oh, it is. It's not sophistry. It's Socratic. It's the teaching us what reason is, what critical thinking is. You know, not a critical thinking isn't a put down. It's an examination, and then applying that to words and that have and must have significant bearing to our understanding. And we're not, these are not necessarily conversations we fall into every day. What is justice? Is it better to live a good life than a criminal life? Tell me about talk to me about the exploitation of people. Is it easier to ignore when you're profiting from it? Or do I need a forgiveness that I can pay for somehow to soothe my conscience? Ah, guilt? Yeah. Guilt has quite a bit to do with it. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just erase that part of your conscience and then you could be as feeble-minded as the animals around? Masonry is something that you can do because it's only you, that the understanding comes from you doing it. Well, I don't mean that in a teleological sense. I mean that you can listen to other people describe it, but I'll describe riding a bicycle to you, but that doesn't, and I'll tell you, pedal fast, steer this way, but until you experience that sense of balance for yourself, you know, that learning is still ahead of you. Masonry requires that kind of understanding. It's one of the beauties of the craft. Now, I think it's really clumsy, but it's an interesting enough illustration, and I'm still sipping on a cappuccino here, to say that everybody can learn how to ride a bike. I don't know that, but I want to say that. Everybody could benefit from the values of Freemasonry? Well, I think you'd need to buy the next round and we'll sit back in front of the fire and have that conversation, because I'm not necessarily convinced. If you're including everybody, I would say no. I'm too old to have that. My rose-colored glasses have broken. And they've been replaced with something much more vivid and more interesting. That sense of reality. Catch your breath. Start looking around and understanding what's going on. Giggle or joy. It's interesting. That understanding, that encouragement, like hopefully Masonic Effects does that for you, encourages you to discover, to explore, to question for yourself. So that, and to argue about and debate issues, striving for meaning, not contradictions. You know, don't need to be in an arena with people that are just contradictory, that or oppositional, that serves no purpose, no purpose at all, but to search out those people capable of proposition, stringing together ideas in sentences that you can then examine against your own propositions and the propositions of others. You find thinkers will tend to encourage everybody else in the room to expound and pontificate before they speak. It's a way of learning so that you don't taint the results. So you don't trigger the contrariness of one, and the aggression of another, the ambition of yet another. You let it unfold in front of you and see. And generally we have a great many opinion. And if you're talking to a crowd that's more adolescent than mature, you know, when we're adolescent, we didn't need a lot. We didn't depend on a lot of fact in order to support our ideas or our opinions. No. We would ooze opinion. Do you need to know how to run the World Bank? Well, just ask me. I was 18 and 17 and 18 once. I'll tell you how to end the war and famine. And I'll tell you, I had the answers. But were they applicable? Could they work? Well, where does optimists, you know, where does it come together is doing what you do, not with that, you know, that piety that's so offensive that everybody around wants to run away, you know. In my faith, we had one person, that one prophet that had died so that the rest of us could be rid of our problem of sin. And he was so intolerable, he was killed. Those things that I want to be around, I pious people scare the crap out of me now. Me too. I don't know what the hell their game is. Masonry gives us more of a reality check, you know, a very pleasant reality check. Put away the hammer. Put away the hammer. Use it as a gavel if you need to get people's attention. My goodness. That's all. But make it symbolic so that, you know, when we hear that series of knock, it means something to you and I that dozens of people just hear that bang. They don't know what it means. We do, to us, because we have these common language, common value. How far you go, that's not on me or somebody else to, you know, we're going to open the top of your head and we're going to flush out what's already in there. We're going to fill it with these wonderful, amazing ideas. No, you do this at your own pace. The beauty of it is takes a bit of self-discipline. It's like the self-discipline of a writer to sit down with pen and paper and start composing. Sitting at the piano. Takes a while. You piece together ideas. Some people have a very dear friend who sees he can conceptualize an entire painting in his mind before he picks up the brush. So if I ask him if he's doing anything, yeah, he has a number of them in his mind. The patience to sit down the way he works is nonstop. Once he starts, it's inspiring, and he has to be driven. Do from from putting up the canvas when it's gessoed and then proceeding from there until he's satisfied with the result. A day or two, it's hard on him now. He's older, man. and it drains him to do that. You say, well, just do little pieces. Yeah, that's fine, but that's not the way his mind works. He has this whole notion of size. And he's a lovely painter who tells me that his primary talent is as a sculptor. Amazing talent. You approach your work similar in your own way, similarly. Your work, I think it gets tedious, and we've just done the encouragement in the same format for far too long, so that it's become a source of irritation. The men that get that would never, they don't need to do that. In fact, it's always interesting when they witness it, because there's always examples around you of that kind of feeble aggression, that attempt. Here, you have to learn this. Well, we do that. Even with children, we learn that there are better and worse ways of teaching. I was brought up where it was corporal punishment. That was a mitigated failure. it allowed adults to, particularly men, to express their aggression and to abuse children and call it teaching. Now we know how to stimulate learning, how to create the opportunity. What was happening when we discovered, can you imagine? We discovered that a form of meditation opened up the mind for children, and that you could do this, and children were quite compliant, imagine that, being in this state every day, and that you could do this with an entire group and then introduce the topic. And lo and behold, they would absorb more information and retain it for a longer period of time than if they were browbeaten, the so-called traditional method. But we have to put that against a cultural backdrop. Different cultures, different ways, different manners. Today we're going to tip into some curious thinking about masonry. But if we can find this a bit meditative or relaxing to begin with, all the better. We're going to. You're already a moral creature. I don't need to beat that drum again ad nausea. Applying it, you already know that. You know most of what masonry will teach, but we get ideas, profound ideas curated, and with them, they stimulate our thinking. And because I'll be quite frank, to do that all the time with all these ideas is with no support. That's hard. I like prompts, mnemonics. I love those, those tricks of the mind. So I don't have to pretend that I have this super memory. I know how to, but I can in fact learn ways to retrieve information when I need it. Yeah, we do that all the time. Some are taught that at an earlier age, and we think of them as the brighter, but they've been taught. The others of us are either self-taught or you learn that as you go through life. Masonry doesn't really talk about the process of learning and absorption, but it does teach it over a very, very long period of time. If you dial it, or where in a jurisdiction where it's dialed in, there's a connection. The men are able to connect, and there's when you can do it and develop a group that think similarly about the exchange of ideas and enjoy one another's company. It is, you begin to have those conversations about the source of happiness and contentment, and you begin to be protective of what you have, and stop parading it around as every man, you know, every man knocks at the door and wants to enter, you just let him. Mm-hmm. So you have nothing, you know, there isn't a stillness that you're there to preserve. Walk across the Zen garden to get to the other side. Is that the idea? Well, we're not exactly a Zen garden here, but we are going to make our way through an interesting program. Sit back here, found some decent music. I think you'll like this. This is the Blue and Green. And the poetry today is just startling. The vibe, I tell you the vibe. 52 years ago today, I was walking in the rain on a dark night, getting up to a place called, that I had been talked into, walking into a place in upstate New York to listen to some music. And didn't have a penny, but my buddy had talked me into it and said, oh, you pay for it. I think the tickets were, $23 for the weekend. That seems, it's a number that strikes me. But when we got there, got into the site, there were no more ticket booths. They had sort of turnstiles. They had been taken out of the way. There were people everywhere. And the music from miles away was fantastic. You could recognize who was on stage. Great. Old guy thinking back on Woodstock. Share the vibe here. Thank you. About bringing our thoughts in line. I don't know. Much of our ritual, and particularly the English ritual, emulation ritual as I know it, was formed after 1813. Before that, it was, Pritchard had it down to 20 pages, but what we have now, that covers about 136 pages. Very, very obscure. Why the interest? I'll take an attempt at it without roughing up the edges about the nature of Freemasonry. This commentary, it only matters because we revere character. Do you have a measure of the effect Masonry has had on us? Of course, it is inconclusive at the granular level. Millions of men, each with his own worldview behind those eyes, means we have the advantage of so many perspectives. Some will seem frivolous, others profound. The set point between those positions is not necessarily conclusive in itself. What is a dream today, as we have learned, might be the inspiration for our discoveries and the applications of science tomorrow. In a way, we were there from the beginning. Men who had understanding were those we valued. They became influences that we elevated by ascribing to them the refinements of character. Just as each of us has that capacity, it is likely our own tendencies and humility that keeps us from such arrogance. It is for others to define character and for us to never stop striving. Eventually, we relax and lose the sense of competition that so often pushes us away from others. You and I, we are fine. Masonry is complicated, obscure, simple when you get it. You may want to find somebody with understanding that resonates through you, so you will want to associate with him until you have learned enough and need to move on. Hopefully, you will be settled in your studies. If you like the way Masons of Bavaria go about their business, emulate them. If you have found the grace of London or authenticity of Edinburgh Masonry, you can pick up on those traits too. In all likelihood, we absorb so many influences that we become a hybrid version, made tolerant, knowing there is no need to validate your thinking further than you have, knowing you have put in the necessary work. Where rationalizing and truth start and stop, I can't tell you. It is a question that we put to ourselves. It is a capability of intelligence, and thus the need for a moral rudder. Subservience may not be to a man, but an idea. Listen to ritual for cues. It's full of them. And respect your ability to learn when you err, and you will do well.
So lucky to
sometimes it just puts you in a mood listening to some music like that, doesn't it? I've been attracted to this poet that we're going to talk about today since I first read a little bit about him and found that I wasn't so much making judgments about his history and all the allegations. This was a scandalous young man, and I begin to think that he had a great deal of courage to do what he did. He was born the 22nd of January, the same day as my wife. But he was born in 1788. This is George Gordon Noel, the 6th Baron Byron, Lord Byron. And he inherited, he was only 3 years old, he inherited his title from his great uncle in 1789. Topical kind of a guy. He went up to school in Edinburgh and he was educated at Harrow and Cambridge. And then he left for a gap year. He went for a two-year tour, a number of Mediterranean countries. That was not uncommon in the day. It'd been going on for quite some time. And that's where he, when he returned in 1811 and in 1812, he came. The first two cantos of Childe Harold's Pilgrimage were published. And this guy became famous overnight. And with fame comes scrutiny. Yeah? Byron's half-sister, Augusta, gave birth to a daughter in 1814. And it was thought that it was most probably Byron's half-sister. Mm-hmm. The following year, Byron married Annabella Melbank, and they had a daughter, his only legitimate child, but that couple separated shortly after. Anyway, ups and downs, scandalous affairs, huge debts. He left England in 1816 and never went back. He spent the summer in Lake Geneva with Percy Bysshe Shelley, other poets, and his Shelley's wife, Mary, and Mary's half-sister, Claire Clermont, with whom Byron had another daughter. Busy guy. And then he traveled on in Italy, where he used to live for more than 6 years. He stayed in Venice, had an affair with Teresa Guiccioli, the wife of an Italian nobleman. And this is when he wrote some of his most famous work. Anyway, scandalous, put in prison for his homosexuality, left England to join the Greek insurgents, and they're fighting a war of independence against the Ottomans. My goodness. Interesting man. Now, this is the poem today is Darkness. And this is written in what's called blank verse. No rhymes, but a stream of ideas. And it was written in July of 1816. That, and many of the two lines, I don't think I'm going to get into all of it with you today. But it's considered one of the best poems ever written on the theme of darkness. And so I thought it would resonate with this crowd. It serves as a warning against the growing inequality in Byron's time and a prediction of what will happen to the planet if the human race does not change. Oh my. See what I mean? Yeah, in the background, I've been scratching my head about what the intellectual topics of the day are. Because it begins with a description of the sun and stars and the moon being extinguished and the earth being left to stumble through space without direction. All the people of the earth have been doomed to lose. They burn everything around them, from the huts and eventually religious material. And they're desperate for any kind of light to see. All are made equal by this darkness. Kings are brought the level of peasants and all suffer together. The men burn the forests and weep as they go out. And some are driven mad by the eventual starvation they will end to face. beasts become tame, but are slaughtered by the man, and all save themselves for what will be one of the last times. Many die from starvation until all the world is reduced to two men that become enemies. These men find themselves in the same altar place, amongst the ashes of religious items. They manage to start a small fire and horrified to see one another. They're of fright. The human race now extinct, as are herbs and animals and all plants. All water is still, and the tides no longer go in and out because the moon is long since extinguished. The clouds are gone, useless to the darkness, which is now the universe. It begins. You'll remember Martin Luther King when you hear this first line. It's where I had a dream. Yep. I had a dream which was not all a dream. The bright sun was extinguished and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space. Rayless and pathless, and the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the moonless air. Morn came and went and came and brought no day, and men forgot their passions in the dread of this their desolation. And all hearts were chilled into a selfish prayer for light. And they did live by watchfires and the thrones, the palaces of crown kings, the huts, the habitations of all things which dwell, were burnt for beacons, cities were consumed, and men were gathered round their blazing homes to look once more into each other's face. Happy were those who dwelt within the eye of the volcanoes and their mountain torch. A fearful hope was all the world contained. Forests were set on fire, but hour by hour they fell and faded, and the crackling trunks extinguished with a crash, and all was black. The brows of men by this despairing light wore an unearthly aspect, as if fits the flashes fell upon them. Some lay down and hid their eyes and wept, and some did rest their chins upon their clenched hands and smiled, and others hurried to and fro and fed their funeral pyres with fuel, and looked up with mad disquietude on the dull sky, the pale of a past world, and then again with curses cast them down upon the dust, and gnashed their teeth and howled. The wild birds shrieked and terrified did flutter on the ground and flap their useless wings. The wildest brutes came tame and tremulous, and vipers crawled and twined themselves around the multitude, hissing but stingless, and they were slain for food. And war, which for a moment was no more, did glut himself again. A meal was bought with blood, and each sate suddenly apart, gorging himself in gloom. No love was left. All earth was but one thought, and that was death, immediate and inglorious. And the pang of famine fed upon all entrails. Men died, and their bones were tombless as their flesh. The meager by the meager were devoured. Even dogs assailed their masters, all save one, and he was faithful to a course and kept the birds and beasts and famished men at bay. Till hunger clung them, or the dropping dead lurked their lank jaws, him sought out no food, but with a piteous and perpetual moan and a quick, desolate cry, licking the hand which answered not with a caress, he died. The crowd was famished by degrees, but two of an enormous city did survive, and they were enemies. They met beside the dying embers of an altar place where they had been heaped a mass of holy things for an unholy usage they'd raked up and shivering, scrapped with their cold skeleton hands, the feeble ashes and their feeble breath, blew for a little life and made a flame, which was a mockery. They then lifted up their eyes as it grew brighter and beheld each other's aspects, saw and shrieked and died. Even of their mutual hideousness, they died. Unknowing who he was upon, whose brow famine had written fiend. The world was void, the populous and the powerful was a lump. Seasonless, herbless, treeless, manless, lifeless. A lump of death, a chaos of hard clay. The rivers, lakes, and ocean all stood still, and nothing stirred within their silent depths. Ships, sailorless, lay rotting on the sea, and their masts fell down piecemeal as they dropped. They slept on the abyss without a surge. The waves were dead. The tides were in the grave. The moon, their mistress, had expired before. The winds were withered in the stagnant air, and the clouds perished. Darkness had no need of aid from them. She was the universe.
I'm sorry.
You begin to wonder sometimes, don't you? Begin to wonder, when do we move away from rethinking the intellectual hot topics of that day, 19th century, 18th century, begin to embrace the, think about the topics around us today? Are we not Masons? Are we not trying to digest an obscure ritual that wasn't there at the start? It wasn't created to illustrate some ideas. Utopian tendencies. You know, it's hard to talk about the history of Masonry without reflecting on Thomas More's work. Here, in this passage, we're addressing some of the, an uplifting kind of a sense, I think. Reforming and utopian tendencies within 18th century British Freemasonry generally never obscured the more typical and widespread Masonic dedication to harmony and moderation and conviviality and the social cohesion within the lodge. This stoical, even complacent serenity, however Epicurean might be the fraternizing that accompanied it, directly imitated the harmony and order of the universe as revealed. Big step there in that logic. Of course, by science it was revealed. In a well-known piece of Masonic propaganda, intended for a French audience, but of English origin, and possibly even translated by the Newtonian scientist Jean Dussolier, this harmonic and microcosmic relationship of the lodge to the larger macrocosm is developed at some length. This is particularly forceful piece of Masonic propaganda written after a series of police raids on lodge meetings in Paris and in the wake of the papal condemnation of 1738. The Relation apologique et historique de la Société de Franc-Maçons argues that nature itself authorizes the Masonic Lodge, and in turn is the place where science is learned under the guidance of Isis or Minerva, and where nature is mastered. Scientific lessons are actually given at the lodge meetings, and in many cases, a discovery about nature or a demonstration of one of her phenomena has been more delicious than the best wine. The gaiety never exceeds the bounds of reason, politeness, and modesty. There is scattered evidence, mainly from the early decades of speculative Freemasonry, that scientific lectures were given. The value of science rather than its content was certainly a common theme in Masonic literature. The original impulse for the promotion of science within the lodges was English and Newtonian. Although forced to compete with feasting and conviviality, science does manage to teach the Freemason a lesson that is the essence of his religiosity. The universe is composed of many things, yet there is a unity amid this multiplicity. That unity is God, eternal, immense, and wise. He is the all, of which each being is a product. Science sanctions theism, nothing more and hopefully nothing less. This defense, intended for a continental and largely Catholic audience, like so many other pieces of Masonic literature, called forth a single creed, one that could be embraced by a variety of Christians as well as Mohammedans and Jews. Another tract put it, only within Freemasonry can that creed be practiced. This society alone redounds to the honor of the great parent of nature and architect of the universe, worthy of man whose greatest happiness is society, whose supreme dignity is humanity. This universalism makes sense not only as propaganda, but also as a true reflection of early Masonic history. We'll save the next bit. We're going to get into the pantheists like John Tolan. So we'll save that. You see the idea that here that we were still dominating the earth, still not in harmony, but supreme to nature. And we're quoting nature, that development on the science of Newton. I must speak to some Wiccans, Druids about this. Finish off with Stefan Grappelli here. This is from a live performance in San Francisco. I don't think we need to take an obscure ritual like emulation and make it any more difficult. And I think it's time we brought things into a focus on our microscopic view. Look through the eyepiece, we want some clarity. For that reason alone, I want to make sure that we identify even the traces or footprints of aggression. It's just a distraction. The imposition of any idea has no place in Freemasonry. Freemasonry is not an imposition. Nor is understanding science a declaration of the supremacy of mankind over all that is in the dominion. It's an analysis, a uniform language that we use to work our way through ideas. Especially today, when I ask that question of myself and of you, about the hot intellectual topics of the day, perhaps existentialist crisis would be prominent. The notion of humanity, the nature of war, what of tribalism? Are we still tribal? We are still coming to terms with this, because it's a renewed question with each generation, each subsequent generation. It's not like one casts us adrift, the last generation casts us adrift, and we're left with no way of reconnecting with the ideas, rethinking them, coming up with different conclusions, our own conclusions. Progress. So as you go about your business this week, the ability to be a Mason, to experience these philosophies is in the doing. Not something artificial. This isn't artificial. Maybe it's as natural as, you know, to redefine the force would be when you take dance lessons, you know, and all of a sudden you were in front of Glenn Miller's revised orchestra and you're doing the two-step with your favorite girl. Force? Not exactly force. It's like being part of that rhythm. And you are part of the rhythm of Freemasonry. From the beginning, this is doing, all these rituals, is instilling a sense of understanding and raising some questions along the way for you to answer. Are you thinking that there is a correct answer? Well, there's some answers are more thorough and more reliable, but start where you are. And if your answer is insufficient, you'll know. If it's a partial answer, you'll know, because your discovery is the one that's most important to you. Uniformity? Well, okay. It's like I'm going to be sitting in a stadium with tens of thousands of other people watching a football match, and I want to be there when PSG takes the field with their stars. And you're thinking, you're telling me there's only one mindset? Come on. Maybe you don't like Messi. Maybe you think that Neymar doesn't belong on the same field. But what if all these different fans cheering away? Enjoy your week, as I hope you will. I hope the show has been a bit uplifting. I'm going to go back and reread Byron's poem, because that struck me as that might be worth pouring out a dram or two and taking a deep breath and thinking again. In the meantime, commit those acts of random sonic kindness. And you might want to include yourself in that mix, eh? I pray that you're safe wherever you are, you and yours. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.